It is my great pleasure to welcome, for the first time to these Thursdays at Many Rivers events, Sandra Lee Ernest, the author of this book, Embrace of the Daemon, and the author of an upcoming title, which is Love and the Mystery of Betrayal, Initiation of the Heart. Sandra, as I was told by one of the people in the audience today, wrote this book in conjunction with or as part of your dissertation, if I'm not mistaken. And we're hoping to get her back for a presentation about that new book coming out in March, I am told. But we are so delighted to have you join us here to get our January off to a great start here at Many Rivers Books and Tea. Welcome, and please join me in welcoming Sandra Lee Ernest.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming out. I'm so warmed by seeing so many people that I know are on my side. I'm kind of nervous. I haven't been out in public in a long time. I've been in a cave phase, so this is coming out for me. So thank you so much for you coming out and showing up tonight. So I appreciate it. Speaking up, yes, well, the fact that I'm a little nervous. So
don't be nervous.
I'm going to work on that. That helps. I can walk my talk about loving what you fear, right? That's the idea. So I wanted to start with a little meditation, maybe 3 minutes. And I have my own bell here, so I'll ring it. But I wanted us to take a little grounding into our hearts for starting. And I was going to suggest, if you want to, that you take the time to ask your heart if there's an intention for you for the hour or so that we're going to spend together, and see if we can get a little group heart going with our intentions and with our focus on the heart. So this will just be a 3 minute time to collect and get in touch with ourselves. when Rob encouraged me to do this talk, it was several months ago, probably more than 6 months ago, when this book was re-released. I was sure I didn't want to talk about this book, and I was sure that I didn't want to come out in front of people, but he was persuasive, and now here we are, and I agreed, and I have been involved in writing this other book for the last 3 years or so, and I thought, well, how can I come and really speak from my heart, speak my truth about what's going on for me when I've been so involved in this other subject? And so what it encouraged me to do was to really think about and review the commonalities in the two works. And I really appreciate having the opportunity to do it, because it's kind of glaringly obvious. It wasn't obvious to me, but it's glaringly obvious now that both of them were efforts to grapple with my own suffering. And I don't know what else could force a person to do what you have to do to write a book. If you've ever tried to do it, it's quite a job. So that led to the topic, and the Rilke quote has been important to me. Perhaps everything that frightens us is in its deepest essence something helpless that wants our love.
Could you put that up and read it so you can hear?
You couldn't hear it?
No. But you're looking at it.
Yeah, good. Tell me, because I'm, you know, I'll get it. I'll get there, but I'm feeling, you know, my throat is like, oh God, people, there's my deepest fear, and I'm supposed to love it. I'm not doing it. Falling down on the job already. Okay. Perhaps everything that frightens us is in its deepest essence something helpless that wants our love. How I tried to practice this, people. Right? In fact, this is my religion. And so I've faltered in my religion. I mean, sometimes I feel that it's quite important that we do this, and that it's the reason I'm on the planet, actually. And other times it feels like it's really a bad idea. That I should be right, changing the subject. I must be wallowing. I must be because it's gone on so long, and I mean, really, isn't it supposed to go away if you're nice to it? That's, I think, the hidden agenda in at least my work. So. I guess what I also have learned in this time working on this book and then on the second book, and I'll tell you a little bit about how they both came about in a minute, but I think I've come to something I read about for years, decades, and that I've really come to live it on a daily basis much more than I ever did, that really we all are suffering. I mean, we all are carrying a deep wound, and that most of the time we are not in touch with it, and that we pretty much build our lives so that we don't feel it. We're all wanting something that's missing in our lives. And that feeling of something missing takes all these different forms, you know, craving for something out there to make it go away, to make it better. And I think getting to the heart of that wound and not flinching with it is something that we're called to do deep in our soul, and that I know most people here are on some kind of spiritual path, that's what we do with and for each other, is to help each other to recognize our shared suffering and to do the best we can to find a way to live with it, the best possible way to live with it. So I think that in the heart, I'm kind of getting to something I would like also to be living. I want to love what I'm afraid of, and sometimes I really know that in the middle of that wound is this deep yearning for love. Like, I'm yearning for something. I'm yearning for connection. I'm yearning for love. I'm yearning for God. And I think we all are. I think is what, you know, my great wisdom has to impart here. That one of the reasons I was so reluctant to come out in front of people is the last few years I've kind of gone from the realm of the gods in the Buddhist sense, happy, ecstatic, blissful kind of experiences from a lot of my depth work, into like hell realms, hungry ghost realms, and really have my my practices, my self-image pretty challenged. I would say crushed, actually. Crushed. So the story of this book is probably about, gosh, it's been almost 20 years ago when the first images started to break through around this book. When I was reflecting again back on what was going on at the time in my outer life, I hadn't thought of it, but I'd been in a Gurdjieff group at that time, for a community, actually, a very tight community, living with other members of the community, teaching in that tradition for more than 10 years. And I had become profoundly disillusioned with that system, which was one of my idols, and also the teacher of the system, who turned out, as many of our great leaders, teachers do, to have been somewhat wildly dishonest, actually, and abusing his power in various ways, and it's one of those blows. So that was what was going on in my outer life, and it's odd that the new book also is associated with something that I consider a betrayal, and that was a betrayal. But I started to have these breakthroughs of very dark material in my psyche that was quite disturbing at the time, especially because I'd been doing these practices where you don't express negative emotions and you deconstruct whatever comes into your mind. Images were just excretion of the mind. I thought I was pretty good at deconstructing these things, but none of my practices were working. So I'm going to read a little bit from this, just because I'd like you to have a little feeling for what this book is about. It did get turned into a dissertation, and then it got published as a book about 10 years ago, so I revised it, and it's come back out last year. So it's couched in Jungian theory. It's the home that I found for what I was experiencing. The Jungian and archetypal psychology was really helpful for helping me understand. My own interest in imaginal realms began with a series of confounding invasions of demonic imagery into my everyday life. Some months after the birth of my daughter, my wonderful daughter who's here, startling episodes of spontaneous, non-ordinary states of consciousness began to intrude upon my comfortable orientation to reality. Repulsive, sometimes horrifying images burst into my mind at odd hours of the day and night. In a flash, my inner life would shift from the ordinary landscape of the wash-the-dishes patter
of relived events of the day, the chatting with the dog, or planning for tomorrow, to one teeming with images of harrowing mythological creatures, axe murderers, tarantulas, rapists, rats, maggots, snakes, in surreal settings like a Salvador Dali painting. Was I losing my mind? Had I tapped into a sadomasochistic shadow self? Was a demon force from the collective invading me? Was I having flashbacks to childhood? Or was this a nightmare hallucination breaking into my daylight world? Needless to say, I was deeply disturbed by the insistent reality of these images over which I seemed to have little control. So, these scenes left me disturbed, and they left me concerned about my sanity for a while. And I started, when they would start to come on, I started doing like a form of automatic writing. So I recorded what was coming out, and later I could go back and see what I wrote, and that's part of what makes up the book. Some of those images and the way that they evolved. I devised a method grew inside of me for working with this material as it came up. And it was essentially focusing on the sensations that would come up with these images, and staying with the positive sensations, kind of a form of focusing in some ways, and letting the images grow and develop, and it was very fruitful to apply that methodology to this imagery. And it began to produce these very full, enlightened states for me, states of blissful, kind of ecstatic states, by going into these horrid images and focusing on the positive, the little tiny bit of positive sensation that is associated with them, and letting it develop. And the image itself, there was a lot of visual in it, the image would change, and it would morph. And it was a very creative process. And I thought, wow, I've got my ticket to paradise here. And so I had a method that worked for me for a long time for working with afflictive emotions that would come up, with images that came up, with any difficulty I was having in my inner life. So I went. Embarked on a phase of my life that I would say was had a lot of ecstatic quality to it. As I said, the things that were happening when the images first came had to do with the breakdown of the system of that was very important to me of thought. I stayed in that Gurdjieff work for another 10 years, by the way, but the first 10 years I was very, very into it, teaching it and living it like it was the Bible. And in the course of working on this, my husband was diagnosed with lymphatic cancer, and 4 years later he died. So I was in this field that was had a lot of pathos and a lot of poignancy and a lot of grief and a lot of deep touching into some stream of life that is normally not that available, a lot of suffering. But I learned through losing him and through continuing to work with this material that there was something amazingly liberating and numinous and promising about staying with pain and staying with suffering. And I know that that's kind of a tenet for a lot of us, to stay with our suffering and do the best we can to embrace it. And I thought, as I said, I thought that was my, I thought my PhD was in that subject, that I was good at that. Excellent.
some years after my husband died, I was ready for another relationship, and I got involved with someone. And the genesis for the new book was after 6 years together, he basically left me, kind of without warning, a few weeks before a big wedding that we had planned. And his subsequent personality change and involvement with a series of women, it broke me. It took me down like nothing had affected me before in my life. I didn't know at the time. I was deeply traumatized, and I didn't understand what was happening to me. I just didn't get it. The way I coped is I started sitting like 4 to 6 hours a day. I was applying my practices like a maniac, just sitting, observing, you know, trying to do my practices, trying to use inquiry, because I was also in Diamond Heart for years after I left the Gurdjieff work. I'd been going on Vipassana retreats. I mean, I'd probably done 40 of them. So there I was with all my equipment, hunkering down. I'm going to get through this. It's going to be fine. And it just got worse and worse. So I learned a lot of things. I've learned a lot of things about suffering, I think. At the same time as I've learned a lot of things about suffering, I feel like I don't know very much. Maybe that's that. I think that's good. I actually do think it's good. But so I want to read this. Oh, it is Rumi. I thought it was Hafiz. I was telling Carl about it. So. Before I read this, I want to tell you, just make the point, the 4 points. There are 4 things that I thought I learned that I want to share, and I also want to hear from you guys about this. But I learned that to transform suffering is not, it goes beyond being a skill. I think it is a skill. You know, like playing the piano or something, you have to learn how to do it. And I thought I was kind of skilled, but it's also an art form, and there are degrees of difficulty. And, you know, some things just take us to our edge. And when we're brought to our edge, when we're brought to the end of our psychological and our spiritual resources, we suffer, and we have no choice. It's not optional. It's just not optional. That was a big deal. That was a big deal to realize that it's not optional. And that I didn't have, that I, moi, the PhD in dealing with suffering, could not. I tried everything. I mean, I won't even. It's in the new book, and nothing was working. I mean, I tried new systems, Course in Miracles. I spent a couple years on that one. I mean, trying to forgive. Oh yeah. Oh boy, was I a failure at that. I mean, that's like way out, that stratosphere. I mean, I just tried everything. One thing that was good was I reaped so many insights about it, and I was getting so much download of information in the middle of this pain that I decided I'm going to write about it. I want to share it with other people. And because, I mean, really, who has the time when they go through something like this to sit for 4 or 5 hours a day and explore what's going on? So it was kind of a rare and amazing opportunity
And I felt so many times like I was connecting into something collective. That the pain that I was going through, the unbelievable despair and the grief and the whole long list of things that I didn't even think was possible for a person to feel, that it's human. And that, my God, we're the way we're constructed, the potential for pain is enormous. And we need to know how to deal with it. So skill is not enough. Skill helped, but it's an art form, and there's something about touching into the thing I started with, that the deep core of our suffering, to recognize what it really is. And I could put words on it. I could put words on it 25 years ago, but I couldn't really live it until, and even now, I'm not saying I'm living it, but I have a little bit more. A feeling that it is true, that the source of our suffering is our separation from God. It is the source of our suffering. And that the yearning that's hidden behind fear, behind anger, behind outrage and despair and meaninglessness, and whatever your cup of tea is in the suffering department, is a deep cry for help. Help. I want love. I want warmth. I want protection. I want home. It's deep. It's a deep... we all know it. We know it, right? We all know it. It hides. We have all the idols that we go after, thinking that it's going to somehow... We're going to get it out there somewhere. I knew better, but it doesn't matter, especially if trauma comes. So one writer I was reading said God is always a trauma. That's the initiation into the dark. A trauma initiates you into the dark night, and one of the reasons I think is your neocortex goes offline. So forget concentrating, forget focusing. Forget trying to, you know, apply everything you know, because now you are being controlled by the early brain. And the early brain is scared, and it's angry, and it's going to protect you in this most basic caveman way possible. And you are like, gone! You are subject to this early brain. Until it decides to go offline, or you go do a bunch of trauma work. Hey, I did a lot of trauma work. This last year has been good. It's better. But I didn't know it hit me. Especially if you don't know if you're traumatized, it gets really dementing, because you've basically lost your mind. And what does it force? It forces us to our knees. It just forces us to our knees. It forces that sense of knowing that we are indeed powerless. That everything that frightens us is something helpless. We are deeply, deeply, deeply helpless. Deeply in the place in ourself that gets frightened. That's the helpless place. And from that helpless place, it's almost like right there is the door. Right there is it's the key to the lock that can open us to the warmth of heart, and that can open us to that amazing presence that can come into us, that can actually satisfy the longing, that can actually fill our veins with warmth and with love and with wonder and with not realizing that we don't know what we're doing here and that we're in an amazing mystery. and not just knowing it here, but like knowing it in our blood, in our veins, that, wow, you know, I exist. And that is like an incredible, amazing fact. And at the place of our helplessness, at the place of our fear, at the place of our hurting, if it's held, if somehow we can meet it, I think our part is about 20%, the skill part. I mean, we have to do it. I mean, we have to try to line ourselves up as best we can. But then we're just waiting, and we're praying. So what's come for me now about pain is it's a prayer. Pain is a prayer. Suffering, it is, we're praying. We may not even realize we're praying, but we're praying. And if we can take our 20% and line it up with the messages that are coming through the pain and through the suffering, we can get to the real deep desire of our heart. That deep, deep desire. The deep, true desire that wants connection, that wants love, that wants truth. Instead of the other things that we're always going for. So this is from the new book. I'll take a breath. I wondered why this terrible thing had happened to me. As I began to intimate the extent of my devastation, I also wondered why one person might be unaffected, even strengthened, and another destroyed by such a trial. I found no solutions, but I could not stop asking these questions, looking for any answer, any port, any safe harbor in this perfect storm that was dismantling my reality. If I understood, I imagined I might regain some control of my destiny. The most honest explanation I came up with, we don't ever give up over here, was that no one really knows why things happen to us. I unearthed an abundance of theories, a cornucopia of karma, grace, mercy, evil, the devil, sin, ego projections, infantile or generational trauma, accident, attachment, repetition compulsion, possession by spirits, just to name a few. But they only revealed the confusion we face when trying to understand the apparent randomness of painful events and misfortunes. This randomness, I concluded, applies not only to the inexplicable sorrows of good and bad people alike, but also to whether we are eventually renewed, reduced, or ruined by such experiences. In the larger scheme of things, the scary truth we do not want to admit is we simply do not know. So this is a Rumi poem that I've had on my fridge, and that, say again, this is the, I've actually landed in this space a lot of times after desperately trying in various ways to heal myself. Be helpless and dumbfounded, unable to say yes or no. Then a stretcher will come from grace to gather us up. We are too dull-eyed to see the beauty. If we say yes, we can, we'll be lying. If we say no, we don't see it. The no will behead us and shut tight our window into spirit. So let us not be sure of anything besides ourselves. And not only that. No, excuse me, besides ourselves, and only that. So miraculous beings come running to help. Crazed, lying in a zero circle, mute. We will finally be saying with tremendous eloquence, lead us. When we've totally surrendered to that beauty, we'll become a mighty kindness. That's Rumi. So, I was going to invite you to take a minute or so to check in with yourself about what's causing the most suffering in your life, and what appears to be causing it, and what that suffering feels like on the inside. You know, what is it that trips you up internally and causes you pain, pain or fear? You know, just to take a minute to see if you can connect in with whatever that might be. I'm going to stop talking now for a minute.
know if you can notice the sensations around whatever the issue is that's come up for you. Some people that'll probably be easy if you're more body oriented, sensation oriented, but if you can find it in your body, tightening or heartbeat a little faster, or tummy tightening, or numbing out, whatever it might be. Try to bring a little bit of attention to those sensations. I don't know if you can generate or recall what your intention was when we started, but whatever was coming out of your heart or feeling in the heart, is it, I invite you to bring that quality to the discomfort or the fear or the problem, the way you hold it in your body. I don't know if anyone cares to share what you observed or what's going on for you, but it would be lovely to have some other voices in the room besides mine right now. if anyone cares to share, please do.
Noticed as I was thinking about what I wanted to say that I could feel the warmth in my throat, and what I understood as an internal dilemma was that creates a lot of discomfort for me is the wanting things to be different than they are and being unwilling to change.
Thanks. Thank you. Revealing yourself.
What I'd like to say is John and I go to a lot of talks, and we've heard a lot of people talk about a lot of spiritual things. This is what a talk should sound like. I just wanted to say that.
Rachel.
And my fear is not having control. And at the beginning, when you asked us to bring a prayer, to bring something, I was thinking, you know, love and support for you.
Aww.
And then it felt really, really nice to have it come back for myself, to have, oh, the love and support for me. And so I thought that that was nice.
I came to support you, and because Russ said we're going, I'm like, oh, okay, guess we're going. I'm like, why am I going? Why did I need to be here? And as soon as I read what the topic was, because I didn't even really know what the topic was, I'm like, oh, that's why you brought me. Like, the universe said, no, this is exactly what we're needing to deal with right now. And I actually am a public speaker, and I help teach people to
oh,
speak.
I should have come see you. I missed my chance.
And but my real gem is to have people be really authentic. Like to not, like there isn't that whole, it's like I try and take apart everything else everybody gave them so they can just be themselves and be captivating from that point of view. So for that, I'm like, oh, this is perfect. And but what I've been grappling with is I personally was on a call the other day where I was supposed to be the expert being interviewed, and I hadn't been talking to people in months either about what I do, and I'm like, oh, I'll just, I'm good, I can do this. And the interviewer's call dropped, and he left me to fill the hour just talking with no script and no plan. And I'm like, I can fill space, but this isn't really my idea, you know. And I got off the call really like, okay, I survived that, you know, and we're having a replay, an encore on Monday, and I'm like, I don't want to tell anybody. I don't want to announce it. I don't want to send it to my people. I'm embarrassed. I'm like, I'm never going to do this again. I got off a call with one of my clients just before coming here. He wanted to know how much more, you know, what would it cost to do more with me. I'm like, I don't know, I'll tell you later. I couldn't, I am so off my game, off my, like, how do I, I'm like, I should just never do this again. I'm just, who thought this was a good idea to begin with? You know, like all that stuff that comes up to take me out of the game instead of, okay, no, that's just part of the game. And it's like, if it were easy, everybody would do it. And if there's a gift in it, then you have to go through it. So it's the appreciation of the suffering is all part of, instead of a sign of, get that out of here. You know, like, to recognize, like, why am I going through this? And part of it, I think, is because my speakers go through this, and I'm like, oh, this is easy. And they're like, no, you don't understand. And I'm kind of like, oh, crap, that's what they go through. You know, so, anyway, that's where I am in the process, and I'm grateful for being here.
Thanks. Thank you for sharing. It's good to hear your voice. Sure.
I was really struck by your discussion about trying this system and trying that system and trying that system. And I've had a meandering journey through spiritual perspective myself. But what struck me is that that's a very peculiar problem in history. In most periods in history, people would simply have a given system. I mean, it's really very unusual to be able to, you know, go from the Gurdjieff to Vipassana to Course in Miracles and stuff like that. And I'm wondering, what struck me when I heard you speaking is, I wonder if that gives rise to some tension and confusion for people. I hadn't really thought of it in that way before. Like it may be a contributory factor to difficulties in comprehending where we are and that sort of thing. And that arose for me, and I wonder if you would comment on that.
Thank you for bringing that up. You bring to mind a talk I was listening to by Don Bison. He's a Jungian therapist, and also he was a monk for a while, so there's a guy who's got at least two traditions going. But he was talking about the dark night of the soul, and he was talking about the comment he made that really struck me, that seems related to what you're talking about, is that when we go into a period of darkness in contemporary culture, people on spiritual paths that actually go into this, and it's a spiritual trial, not just psychological depression, but where you actually still have some faith going on, some sense of there being some holding of the process. That what we're doing is we're grappling with the doubt that's in the mind of the collective, whereas hundreds of years ago, especially when you read the Christian mystics, which is where
some of the dark night material came from, that their dark night came because they thought they were sinners, or they somehow they weren't living up to the system that they were that they were drenched in, that they believed in. But because we have so many systems, we have so many, there's nothing for so many of us that is the truth, that what we're facing is doubt. So we doubt the existence of God, for instance, or spirit, or source, or deep heart and love and a companion presence. We doubt it. I speak for myself. I would say that's true for most of the people that I know, and that's really the source, like I've been trying to say, of our suffering and of our darkness. So it seems related to your point that we do have all these different forms that we can cling to that are so evocative. There's so many wonderful evocative ideas that have enough truth that you want to just grasp onto it like a lifesaver. At least that's me. That's been my... Not everybody does that, but...
So is the tendency, if you have too many alternatives, to flit from one to the other without going as deep as you can into maybe if you only knew one?
That's what they say. I mean, I spent 20 years in Gurdjieff work. I mean, seriously, I think that I gave it a run. I mean, seriously, Gurdjieff work. I mean, Bible. I didn't read anything else but those books. And I pray. So, you know, I feel like I gave that a run. But that's what they say, and that's the justification for staying with one system. I don't know. Right? I don't know.
Maybe
but it's a good point.
Maybe the essential thing is to move so deeply into a system that you exhaust it, and then you begin to come up against the
That's what I think it is. You know, that's what I think meditation is for. You have to meditate to figure out you can't do it. I mean, has anyone else noticed? I mean, Barbara, right?
That's good. I like the way you said that.
I mean, that's what we do it for. I mean, all my practices, all the stuff that I... And I still got that little spiritual director in my head that drives me nuts. And I mean, that's the part that has not surrendered. That is the part that thinks she's in charge.
Yeah, well, that part that you just said, this last thing, reminds me so much of the 12 steps and the first step. And that until you realize you can't get it. Like Pema said, her first teacher, she walked in and what he said was, "Don't think you'll ever get it together." That was her first teaching. And so that tendency of wanting to get it together.
Yeah.
But I think all the we were talking about these sort of different spiritual paths, it's like we hope one of them will keep us from suffering.
Yeah.
And so we go, well, that didn't work, so let me go into this one. And the little quote I read to you from Pema at the beginning is like, we have to, just like you're saying, get to our suffering, not cover it up with, I'm spiritual, I'm fine, but rather just go right in. And that's whatever path can help you do that.
Well, and I, of course, I said I'm in that religion, but I have also spent time, and I want to bring it up because I know I put it on the flyer. I spent a few years, actually before this last trauma crisis abandonment thing, I was doing law of attraction, and I was into the worldview where you do not focus on your suffering. You do the best you can to change the channel, to focus on what you want. It was the whole idea, we know it. I mean, it's a big new thought idea. We create our reality, you know, Seth, Course in Miracles, Law of Attraction, Christian Science. We create our reality, therefore do not focus on bad things or bad things are gonna happen to you. Do not focus on the flaws of your partner, no matter what they're doing to you. So what if they're hitting you? Focus on how lovely they are. You know? I mean, well, yeah, if you get into law of attraction, so I don't know if other people have, but I was into it. So I think, you know, I gave that a run, and gratitude every day, you know, doing the gratitudes and doing the focusing on positive things. That's a way of coping with, that's another way that is recommended in our New Age world, New Age culture, to deal with your suffering. Just change your mind and your life will change. So.
I mean, your life may change, but without the rest of the planet. You know, I think something I read recently in one of the Abraham quotes is there's no such thing as evil. There's only a stream of goodwill.
Yeah.
You know, a steady stream of goodwill. And it's like, okay, well, I don't think you two didn't grow up with my father. What about the headaches and these horrific things that happen on the planet? I mean, you know, and even once we get through what we think is our own personal suffering and we get beyond pretense, because I think that's where doubt comes in. As long as we're pretending there's going to be doubt, as long as we're pretending that everything's cool in our lives and it's together and we're happy. But then once we get to our own personal suffering, how do we meet the suffering of the world, you know, in a way that feels meaningful, relevant, useful, you know? That's I don't know. That's kind of what I'm up against right now.
Mm.
You know, even in the work that I do, you know, in the arts, it's like, who gives a shit, you know? I mean, like, how is it important? How is it useful to the world?
How is your work useful?
Yeah, I mean, or you know what I mean? It's just like, so that's where I think where my own personal suffering comes up.
Well, how you
how
can
you
impact the world.
How do you, know, how do you not approach your death, which you do start thinking about in your 60s, if not before? How do you approach it in a way that you don't just feel like you were a little ant that walked across the concrete and then fell off the edge of the world? With me?
Thank you, Fran. No, that's the truth. I mean, isn't that the truth of our situation, though? I mean, that's what we're facing if we don't have this connection, if we don't have a deeper sense in our hearts that we're connected to the eternal. And that, I believe, is what suffering can open for us. And that's a classic view of suffering. That's, you know, pick up your cross and you'll be redeemed. Buddhist view of suffering, you'll see through the illusion.
I haven't read your book, but the idea of angels and demons, what if there's two aspects of suffering, and that one is like angelic, and if I move into it, it opens me, and another is demonic, and if I move into it, it spirals me into entanglement.
Mm-hmm.
And then my challenge is somehow to discern the difference between those.
Mm-hmm.
And then that brings up this question, in the midst of suffering, how do I steer that in a way that moves towards the angelic direction of opening and unwinding, and not steer into the crazy making darkness?
That's just such an excellent question. Thank you for putting it in the room. Yeah. That's the art form of suffering, the skill and then the art form. I think that's a huge piece of it, because the temptation to form an identity out of the suffering,
mm-hmm,
is rather enormous.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like the ego self is ready to just jump right in there and be completely victimized and, like, you know, I myself vacillate between, you know, a self-image of being like the most broken, pathetic, you know, ruined person on the planet, and then another self-image, oh, I've had all this suffering, therefore I'm exalted and wonderful, and, you know, it's the self trying to hold on to something,
mm-hmm,
and suffering is, hey, I'll take that's as good as anything, it grabs onto that, so it's it's like how it is naming the question is really important. How do we deal with this situation without making it a new identity? And when we do make it identity, we just suffer more, whether it's the grandiose version or the, you know, inferior version. So it's a very big piece of it, and I think the business of realizing how dependent we are on something, grace, whatever you want to call it, on something that we have no control over. It's a mystery. And that we have to, I mean, in my case, and I assume for lots of other people, we just have to be brought to our knees again and again and again and again. And at that place right there, realizing the powerlessness, it's shearing away. I think it shears away that part that thinks it can be in control and the part that gets us in trouble, what you call it, that turns it into a demonic force. If you call demonic something that blocks love, something that prevents us from connecting with our true nature, and angelic, something that encourages it. So the angels are in the helplessness, I think, recognizing it, and then not totally making that an identity. The devils are thinking we can do it ourselves. So
humility is a part of this.
A tiny little part. kind of. I would at least the whole exercise in humiliation for the ego, and then hopefully humbling for the heart. It humbles the heart. I mean, I think suffering rightly taken does produce some humility. It's a beautiful quality when it comes.
I just want to say one of the things that drew me to come to your talk, and I'm delighted to find that it's you, was the list of questions that you posed. And I think that just the fact that you're living in the question and inviting the question is coming from a place of humility and not claiming to have the answers. I appreciate that.
Thank you. We can quickly take on the identity of being a humble person. I'm such a humble person. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's never ending.
Yeah.
And you didn't find that 20 years of Gurdjieff work gave you any tools to cope with these things?
Well, I wouldn't say that. No, I wouldn't say that at all. The Gurdjieff idea that, it's an Uspensky idea, but that what's a door on one level becomes a wall on the next. So I think, I was in love with that system. I mean, I learned so much. It lifted me out of, I was a cheerleader. I was just a rah-rah. When I found the system, it made a deep impact on my life, and I wouldn't be here today without it. I mean, Gurdjieff is amazing. I pray to him sometimes. I just go like, "You did leave us with a fine mess, and why did you do that? And could you please help me out of this situation? I mean, really, what do you mean, man cannot do? I mean, I still have a lot of it going on, and I'm so grateful for it. And I think it's part and parcel of who I am today. But there came a time when the ideas were not right anymore. Not expressing negative emotions. I was taking it in the wrong way. I was in despair. I can't self-remember anymore. I know it's impossible. I'm going to the moon. I mean, it was a long list of stuff. The Gurdjieff work. You know what I'm talking about. Anyway, so no, it did. Definitely. Thanks for asking.
I'm finding myself remembering what the Intergalactic Space Federation said to Jonathan Sparrow about pain when he was just swimming in despair. Can I share that very briefly? He said, "Pain is an ungiven gift, Jonathan. Find a gift and give it. pain is an unasked question. Find a question and ask it. Pain is just the plow to turn the soil of the soul. Pain is love's search for itself. In the search for what is never lost and only found, the drama of the heart unfolds. Accept your pain, become its bane. Become its bane. No, become its flower, use its power.
Wow.
Become its flower, use its power.
Beautiful.
There's something about like the natural intensity of being a human being. Somehow we in this paradigm we do not get the opportunity to be in that. And I think a lot of pain is just calling us to that level of intensity that we're missing.
Yeah.
And we somehow just fall short of it. Being in the more superficial realm causes us to fall short of the real feelings
mm-hmm.
that's involved in being a human being.
That's beautiful. I really appreciate you sharing that. It's spoken to my heart. Yeah. Something about the call of I said I had four things I learned about suffering, and one of them is underneath our pain is a desperate cry for love and connection, and that the pain is trying to get us to pay attention to it, and there's something about that call, that cry, once we actually touch into it. Once we actually feel that, it is prayer, and that is the prayer. I have tried to figure out how to pray for a long time. How do you pray? I don't know. I always get it wrong. I think that is prayer that gets answered. That prayer gets answered, and so it's like this amazing gift. I mean, I'm afraid, like, you know, I get superstitious about these things, but. I'm getting more friendly with some of these places of despair and angst. And when they come on, like, I want to pay attention to them. I want to befriend them. It's like they're visiting me. They're visiting, and they're bringing something. They're bringing something I don't normally have. And I want to honor them, and I want to listen, and I want to try to drop my story around it. You know, even the story that is telling me, oh, I'm angry because of blah, 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 or whatever it is, or this is a repeat of my childhood envy of my sister, or what, you know, my mind is kind of, our minds can... just to try to drop it and listen to the pure message in the pain itself. And what is it really saying? And I get, when I really get in it, I almost always get help. Help. And sometimes it takes the form of, you know, I want love. I want love, really. I mean, love or God. It takes that form. But I'm telling you how my experience. But if you get into the actual experience, the actual sensations, the actual whatever it is that you put such lovely words on that comes with pain, that it's bringing us a gift. It's a door. It's a prayer. And if we honor that prayer, it gets answered. More often than not, that's where my heart starts to get filled with, like,
something awesome, something I'm not alone. There's somebody here with me, something here with me, something is here, and it comes for me, and for some of us it comes through the pain. So my four things, I'm just going to tell you, just to put them out there since I wrote them down. The transformation, I've always said all of them, the transformation of suffering is a skill, but ultimately it's an art form. Two, being broken and brought to our knees and realizing our powerlessness leads us to prayer. It's like automatic. I think it's in our instinctual being that we pray when we're desperate. Two and three, or three, I come to see suffering and pain as a prayer, and four, underneath our pain is a desperate cry for love and connection. And it's a beautiful gift, and I'm going to not say more, because I'm afraid I'll be tested.
There's something that this gentleman over here shared and what you just said that strikes me is you, when you're talking about prayer or wanting love, it strikes me that there's, in this suffering, there's one way of feeling it is wanting or longing for something, and then another thing comes, which is wanting to give that thing. So there's wanting love, and then there's wanting to love. And those two seem in the same place, but I notice for me, if I get caught in wanting love, I'm trapped in a way that I can't ever find it. But when I love, something shifts, and I actually connect to that thing that I thought that I didn't have.
I just went, I get the impulse to get down and bow down to you or something. I'm sorry. That was just my impulse, because it was like, I don't know how to love. I mean, that's how it is for me. I mean, so for me, receiving love, and I don't mean like from you or any other person necessarily, I mean the kind of love that isn't dependent on anything outside. That when it feels to me like that, for me, and other people have different experiences, but for me, that is receiving and giving are the same, right? Mm-hmm. Like that, once I can actually receive. And I, my opinion, I think that's our big problem, is we don't know how to receive love, deep love, that I'm afraid of it. And when it comes in, then I am love. I don't need to try, because if I try, poor raising my daughter, it was like I never knew how to love her. How do you love? What do you do? How do you do it? I don't know how to do it. You know, and every once in a while, since I've been going through so much angst and everything, I feel like, oh, I love her. I get what that is. It's just, you know, I've received love, and it, you know, and then she's part of it, and other people also, but I practice the most with her. So, I don't know. Diana, did you? The opposite.
What he brought up maybe touched on the conclusion is it doesn't maybe go deep enough, but somewhere what we think we want to draw to us that will make us glitter isn't really what we really need to open us up or connect us to something deeper. So I'm curious, like, did you feel like your law of attraction is what practices brought you to that partner that didn't work out? And then
no.
No,
it was afterwards trying to put up with them that I tried the law of attraction, you know. Mm-hmm. Let's just focus on what's positive. No. But thank you for asking that, because
you know, I've thought about it a lot, and I think it's dangerous, actually, the law of attraction. That's my conclusion from my experience. It's dangerous. And it reminded me of something in the Gurdjieff work where don't mess with breath. Don't mess with your breath because it's dangerous. We don't know what we're doing. If you do all these breath exercises and things, you can mess up your organism. So this was don't mess with your thoughts that way, because I had the feeling that I constellated the exact opposite of what I was focusing on. And you know, like somehow our, I'm sure you've seen this, but you know, we're like an iceberg, and the very tip of the iceberg is what we have some conscious control of, and law of attraction, okay, you're sitting there focusing on being grateful for what you have, and you're focusing on visualizing, you know, wonderful futures and getting into the vortex and all these things. You know, you got all this other stuff going on underneath, and we don't know what we're doing. You keep focusing on something, and you constellate the opposite. That's what I think happened. I think you constellated the opposite. John. Yes, it is. It is. It feels right. It feels like this is a good way to avoid suffering. And I mean, I wanted to try it. I decided I was going to be happy, and I was going to be happy every day, and I was working on happiness and focusing on what I loved and all that stuff, and I actually constellated that, you know, I brought out the like devil in this other person instead of the angel, and I was focusing on what an angelic being they were. So yeah, I found like it, I just think it, anything, well, no, don't be making a statement like that. I'm very cautious about the law of attraction. I think it's a half-truth. It's a law of mind. I mean, I do think you can materialize things in your life. Some of us do it naturally. But it's not a law of spirit. I mean, it's not a spiritual law. It feels like it's a mental, something about the mind and the material plane. But what's the cry of the heart? The cry of the heart is not about the material plane. It's about eternity. It's about mystery. It's about not knowing. We don't know what we're doing here. We don't know the meaning of anything. We don't know the nature of relationship. We don't know, I mean, if we've had where we came from or where we're going, right? I mean, and this little tiny mind is going to get it all figured out, what I need and what I'm supposed to be doing and what's best for me. I mean, yes, I have tried that. I mean, yeah. Anyway, so I have been there and done that, and I don't know if that answers anything that you're asking, Diana, but...
And then one other thing that came up is, in the beginning when you described the monstrous visions and how you went into them and developed this process,
yeah,
that actually brought you to ecstasy because you went into the sensations and
right.
It led you somewhere. And in the way you were talking about, the ultimate goal is to go with the pain, but somehow it seems like the pain that came in the next episode that you wrote about in the second book, that method didn't take you where you...
I didn't have the capacity because my mind went offline because the pain was so intense. I think that when the pain is intense enough, it constricts consciousness. It constricts consciousness to the pain itself, and you don't have the capacity. I mean, I went into post-traumatic stress, and I know what that's like from the inside out. And it does, it's a mental illness. Your mind, you don't have a mind, you lose your mind. So this is just from the new book. Chronic pain easily overwhelms higher consciousness and demands attention for itself. Suddenly, I no longer cared about kindness or truth or God or enlightenment. Making the pain stop became my God. Give me back my illusions, I pleaded. Please, I do not care if I'm superficial and deluded. Please just make the pain stop. That was it. That became God, and that was very humbling to my part of me that felt like I was such an exalted spiritual person.
No, I'm thinking that you're like someone that went through surgery with that anesthesia.
That's,
you know,
Fran, you recognize it. Finally someone gets me.
Because you didn't, you know, reach for what most of us would reach for. Oh, pain meds. What else?
Oh, well, I don't know about that.
Thank you for taking that.
My maiden name is Morter, M-O-R-T-E-R. And I've this book has a lot of Jung in it, by the way. Well, they're going to pitch this book again, by the way. This book is not for everyone, but it has a lot of Jung in it, and alchemy, and the Negredo, the Dark Knight Negredo, and Mortificatio being one of the darkest movements in alchemy, the blackest of the black. So Morter is my maiden name. So I go like, you know, I'm here to go through these mortification processes. And I don't know, we all have a different calling, but it just feels like, why did I draw this card? I don't know, but it seems like I did. So, yeah, and then it's a good, I can like go around with my badge. This is who I am now. I don't know. Alchemical unions and separation. I was going to read one more thing from this book because our time is almost up. I don't know what, let me just see. Multi-level. Oh. New land. No. Well, oh, I don't think I'll read them. It's good. I mean, it's not for everyone, but it's you know, some people wrote some really nice things about this book. So if you're into Jungian psychology at all, subtle body. This is about I frame this as the dark feminine, and the emerging of the dark feminine. There's a lot of sexual imagery, sexual violent imagery in here that came through, that I thought was the emergence of very dark erotic forces that are breaking through from the feminine. And you know, I think I've kind of made a good argument for it in here. And and it did open up to a lot of ecstatic experience to work through this, some of this really grimy material that came up. And I talked about integrating the image into the body, the image, the daemon, by the way, not demon, but the daemon is the Greek messenger of the gods that goes between heaven and earth. So some of these imagery, I think suffering is demonic. Your quote that it brings heaven into, it's what it takes to bring spirit into body, to bring spirit into form. And these images, nightmare images, for some people it comes in that form, for other people it's sensations and feelings and all kinds of forms. But you know, we're at a place in history where it's time to recognize what looks terrible, it has God in it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Susan.
One last thing as we're ending. I think Mother Teresa's quoted as, "I know God won't give me more than I can handle. I just wish he didn't trust me so much."
That's good.
Somebody I know has said, "Of course God gives you more than he can handle, more than you can handle, otherwise what do you need him for?"
That's
so
good. Excellent. Thank you. That's perfect. Yeah. That's perfect.
Well, I want to thank Sandra for nourishing us tonight. I want to thank you all for adding to this conversation tonight. And further point out that we have a donation bowl over on the counter. We encourage you to contribute to it because we share that with our speakers to further their work and retain half to help maintain this space for further such events. I'll also point out that we have copies of Embrace of the Daemon and a few other related books over here on the counter, and we hope you will take a look at them and purchase many.
Multiple copies to get your friends. Yeah.
Indeed. And thank you. That was a lovely contribution to our January kickoff for our event series, now over a decade old. Thank you so much for helping out.
Thank you for having me.